when the tour bus plowed into it as it was heading east on the boulevard. MTA Chairman Joe Loda.
These buses spun around. That requires an enormous amount of speed.
Among the dead, a pedestrian pinned the tour bus driver and a passenger aboard the MTA bus.
It's a sad day when three fellow New Yorkers perish while they're getting to work.
In Flushing, Scott Pringle, New York.
Toy seller Toys R Us may be close to filing for bankruptcy. The company's struggling under a mountain of debt, and the company's three owners are looking at a debt restructuring. Analysts say a Toys R Us bankruptcy filing now will give toy makers Mattel and Hasbro a clear view into the company's viability going into the holidays. You're listening to USA Radio News.
Hi, I'm Wayne Allyn. I was one of the biggest critics of Obama in the national media. Suddenly, I was under massive IRS attack. So I hired Sam Landis. Sam did an amazing job. We won twice. I didn't owe a penny. Thank you, Sam Landis. Many of you have IRS problems, and you've spent thousands with non-lawyer tax resolution firms. Do yourself a favor. Call Sam Landis for a free consultation. Trust me, Sam Landis is the best. Sam saved my life. Call Sam at 800-WE-HELP-YOU with the letter U. That's toll-free, 800-WE-HELP-YOU with the letter U. 800-WE-HELP-YOU.
Comedian Kevin Hart issuing an apology to his family on social media for a mistake he made, and he's trying to stop someone from blackmailing him. Here's Jason Campidonia.
Hart says the apology comes after someone tried to extort him.
You know, I'm not perfect. I'm not going to sit up here and say that I am or claim to be in any way, shape, or form.
A video is floating around that reportedly shows the recently married Hart getting cozy with a woman inside a club.
I made a bad error in judgment and put myself in an environment where only bad things can happen, and they did.
Hart doesn't go into what type of mistake was made, but says he's talked with his wife and kid and asked for their forgiveness. There are reports that say someone wants millions of dollars from Hart to keep the video under wraps, and the FBI may be getting involved.
I'm not going to also allow a person to have financial gain off of my mistakes.
Jason Campidonia.
Liberals at UC Berkeley are calling for boycotts of the campus when conservatives will be speaking on campus. Here's Chris Barnes.
Around 180 UC Berkeley professors and graduate students are urging thousands of colleagues and classmates to boycott the campus during next week's planned Free Speech Week. The event will feature appearances by conservative icons Milo Yiannopoulos and Coulter, former Trump advisor Steve Bannon, and others, and it's scheduled to run from next Sunday through Wednesday. However, UC Berkeley officials have also said it may not happen. They claim organizers did not pay required fees and rents for the facilities when they turned in the contract late last week. I'm Chris Barnes.
USA Radio News.
Good afternoon. The weather today is mostly cloudy with a high near 79, east winds around 8 miles an hour. Tonight there's going to be a slight chance of showers after 11 p.m., be mostly cloudy with a low around 63, north winds 6 to 8 miles an hour. And Tuesday, a chance of showers, cloudy, with a high near 73. North winds 11 to 15 miles an hour, and they say the chance of precipitation is 40%. Tuesday night, a chance of showers, mostly cloudy, with a low around 63. North winds 11 to 15 miles per hour, same 40% chance of precipitation. Wednesday is a slight chance of showers, mostly sunny, with a high near 78. North winds 11 to 14 miles per hour, and the chance of precipitation is down to 20%. Wednesday night, partly cloudy with a low around 63. Thursday is going to be mostly sunny with a, supposedly, if they can predict that far in advance, mostly sunny with a high near 79, and partly cloudy with a low around 59 at night. Welcome. This is Mental Health Matters. I'm your host, Larry Cartwright, and my co-host is Tracy Ivey. And this is NAMI's Hour, compliments of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. And NAMI is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And there is a chapter of NAMI in every county in the state of New Jersey, every state in the union, and overseas. In Hunterdon County, we're all volunteers. We have no office, no paid staff. We all work out of our houses. And as I've been told more than once, that makes the commute from the kitchen to the living room very traffic-free. But anyway, what we try to do is we try to help people who either have a mental illness or someone in their family who has one, or they know someone or work with someone. We do it in various ways. We have a support group that meets once a month at 52 East Main Street in Flemington from 7 to 9, and you don't have to register and you don't have to be a member of NAMI to come. You can just show up. We have what they call, which actually just started this past Thursday, a family-to-family class from 7 to 9:30. That you do have to register for. but everything is free. There is no charge for anything. And but with the classes, you have to register. And if you need some more information, all you got to do is call 908-284-0500. That's 908-284-0500. And today, we are very fortunate to have with us Sue Abderholden. Did I say that right? Sue, you there?
Abderholden,
right?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll just call you Sue from now on, if that's all right. And Sue is the executive director of NAMI in Minnesota. So, and welcome, Sue. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Larry.
I want to start. I asked this of everybody I talked to on the show. And how did you get involved with NAMI Minnesota?
Well, I actually did respond to an ad in the paper about the position, but I've worked on disability rights-related issues my entire adult life. I've worked for ARC of Minnesota, PACER, which is our Parent Training and Information Center on Special Education. I actually worked for Senator Wellstone here in the Minnesota office. So in some ways, it was really a natural fit.
Mm-hmm.
And what I really loved about NAMI was the fact that it worked with both an individual who lives with mental illness, family members, and providers. So it's really kind of a very holistic approach to changing the mental health system and the way our society looks at people with mental illnesses. So for me, it really looked like a perfect fit.
It is a challenge to get society to look at people with mental illness like they would look at somebody with diabetes or cancer or something, you know. A lot of times they don't.
And I'm sorry, Larry, but I'm having a little trouble hearing you.
Oh, okay. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. I just have to talk.
And I will say, Larry, just like so many others who work for NAMI, I too have family members who live with mental illness, particularly depression and anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, well, in Hunterdon County, as I'm sure it is in Minnesota, we fall into three categories. Either we're have someone in our family who has a mental health issue, or we're someone who has a mental health issue and is going on with our life, or we just want to help, you know. And that's the three categories that we fall into here in New Jersey, and I'm sure pretty much the same as in Minnesota.
Yeah.
What is the history of Minnesota's mental health movement? And how long
it's
has
kind of interesting. Minnesota actually had its 40th anniversary. We actually began before the national NAMI was formed. And when I kind of look back at the history of the mental health movement in Minnesota, what we found is that it was actually the Unitarian Society who did kind of a study on all of the state hospitals in Minnesota. And they actually went to each one. They took photographs. They wrote what happened. They actually then gave that to the Minneapolis Star, the newspaper here, who ran a big series on it. And then the governor, Youngdahl at the time, was so appalled about the conditions of the institutions, particularly the fact that people were restrained, that on Halloween night he took all of the restraints and straitjackets and everything like that and made a huge bonfire and burned them.
Hmm.
He then founded the first Governor's Mental Health Task Force to really bring people together to start talking about what should be done. So it's kind of interesting to really look at, you know, what happened after that. And at NAMI Minnesota, it was actually a couple of moms, frankly, who got together. They were going to close Hastings State Hospital in Minnesota. And one of the reasons they were going to close it, there were actually two reasons. One is there had been a big federal court case saying that across the country, institutions couldn't use the patients' work for free. So in a lot of the institutions, some of the patients would work in the kitchen or the grounds crew or something like that, but they didn't get paid. And the federal court case said, no, you have to pay people if you're requiring them to work. So a lot of the institutions in Minnesota and other places all of a sudden, you know, had to come up with that money to pay people.
Right, right.
And then we also had a court case in Minnesota for people with developmental disabilities where the court came down and said, no, you actually have to provide treatment. So they were trying to save money, so that we'll close down this one institution that was a smaller one, and we'll take that money and we'll use it in all the other institutions. Well, these moms came together and they said, no, you're not going to do that. You're going to take that money and you're going to put it in the community for people who live with mental illness. You're going to help support them there. And they actually went to the legislature and they got the very first funding. It was called Sharing Life in the Community. And they got funding for the very first community mental health services in our state. Their original name was called Fed Up, which maybe they should have kept that name. And they actually had a quote from a legislator saying, we'll do anything, just call off the mothers.
Yeah. Okay. You know, it's ironic because in Hunterdon County and where we're at in New Jersey, NAMI was started in Hunterdon County by a group of mothers. Also, who had, in most cases, it was daughters with an illness. And I think one mother had a son. And that's how they started, you know, because there wasn't any services or there wasn't any, you know, or very little services at the time.
Do you know how long ago that was, Larry?
I did, but I don't remember
now.
Do you
think it was less than 40?
I think it was probably a little less than 40, yes.
Okay.
But... you know, and they, like I said, it's ironic that it's the same in Minnesota as here. It started by parents, you know, by mothers. Mm-hmm. So,
and you know, typically it's been mothers, whether it was the developmental disability movement, you know, the mental health movement. It's usually predominantly female, and I think partly it's because as mothers, you really, especially you know, 40 years ago, you really had to take care of things. Right, and so you ended up being kind of women became the big kind of advocates and trying to get some of this stuff done, and partly because women, you know, many did not work outside the home during that time as well.
But think back 40 years, what the society felt like towards mental illness, and, you know, it's amazing they had any kind of, you know, help. You know what I'm saying? Because, you know, over the years, it's gotten better. It's certainly not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but think back 40 years ago how it was, and you give these women a lot of credit, you know.
I think it's changed a lot. I mean, I do feel we go out and do a public awareness presentation in the community, and one of the things we ask everyone to do is to shout out every slang word they know for mental illness. And there's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Psycho, crazy, nuts.
Right.
And then we ask them to shout out all the slang words for heart disease or for cancer.
Right.
And, of course, there are none.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really not about being, you know, kind of the politically correct or word police or anything like that, but I think it just kind of shows how little respect and understanding there's been for mental illnesses.
Right.
And we try to encourage people to not use that language into the future.
No, I agree.
But we also see how it really impacts people, you know, kind of on a daily basis. So, for example, you could go to any inpatient psychiatric unit and find out if anyone received a Get Well card.
Mm-hmm.
The answer is going to be largely no.
No.
And you can ask families, did anyone bring a meal, or as we would say in Minnesota, a hot dish, when, you know, they had a loved one hospitalized, and the answer is going to be no. We have, you know, Caring Bridge sites, right, you know, all over the country so that you can connect when people have a serious illness. Very few people actually use it for a mental illness.
Right.
I know of one man who did. His wife convinced him to do it, and he had lived with serious depression on and off his whole life. And he was hospitalized, and his wife said, can we please do the Caring Bridge site so our faith community can provide support? And he finally agreed, and he said, well, put on there that they don't have my favorite pop, and their deck of cards is so worn out you can barely use them. After that, every single day for a week, someone from his faith community showed up with his favorite pop and his cards.
And a deck of cards.
And it was the shortest hospitalization he ever experienced. Right. And he thinks it's because he really felt that warmth and support from his community.
And you know, it's ironic. I had on the former governor of New Jersey's wife, Mrs. Cody, and
I've met her.
Yeah, I have too.
With her work on postpartum depression.
Right, yes. Right, exactly. And she was saying on the air that she had an operation, and everybody in the community was bringing food and coming visiting, and how are you, can we do the laundry, yada yada, all this stuff. When she went into the hospital for postpartum depression, nobody came. Nobody brought anything. And, you know, it was like 100% different from when she went in for, you know, I forget what it was, appendix or whatever. But, you know, it just, and that's the way it is, unfortunately, yeah. You know.
I think it's really unfortunate, too. And even if you think about how psychiatric units operate, people don't have phones in their room,
nope.
Right? You have to call the main number, hope that someone who's in the kind of lounge area of the psych unit will pick up. Very difficult to leave messages. And when you think about even some of the symptoms of mental illness, it makes it hard to reach out to others. And we've just now made it extremely difficult to reach out to someone who's hospitalized with a very serious illness when they need it the most.
Right. No, that's true. And unfortunately, they had closed a mental health, a state hospital here in Hunterdon County, and spent millions of dollars improving one in another county up the ways. And the one they closed was the only state hospital in the state of New Jersey that was making money and was, you know, very good. The staff was wonderful, you know, they cared for the people and yada, yada. And I'm speaking from experience because my son was there for quite a while. But, you know, they moved up to this other hospital. And now you're hearing I'm getting phone calls from people who their son has been overdosed on drugs to keep them quiet and keep them, you know, sedated, being chained or, you know, chained, but, you know, what do you call it, strapped
restrained.
Down and restrained. And, you know, it's just...
Larry, I can interrupt. Why do they close it? What was the rationale?
Well, the real reason, we don't have enough high-powered politicians here like they do up in various other counties like Bergen County, etc. And they pushed the governor to improve the one that Greystone instead of keeping Hagedorn open. But that's another issue altogether.
Yeah, let's get back to Sue.
Can you go over some key issues of children's mental health?
You know, the mental health kind of community, and I think that's true within NAMI as well, hasn't always recognized the need to focus on children's mental health. We kind of think about mental health issues as being an adult issue, but as we know now that, you know, half of all adults began experiencing symptoms before the age of 14, you know, 75% by the age of 24. So it's really important to look at what's happening with children. And we do know that kids who have a serious mental illness have the highest dropout rate from school.
Right.
And if you're not in school, we know that the trajectory of your life usually isn't very good if you've dropped out of high school. So we think it's really important to look at kids' issues. We've seen some great work done on early childhood mental health. They're not, you know, diagnosing children, but usually when you're seeing kids being kicked out of child care, for example, or Head Start, kids struggling in Head Start, they might have had a traumatic experience in their life, you know, been exposed to trauma, and we need to help them, right, kind of deal with emotions and work through things so that they can, in the future, be able to sit in a classroom and do all those kinds of things. I know in Minnesota and across the country that there's actually a high percentage of kids who are actually suspended in kindergarten through third grade. Now, kids are not bad in kindergarten through third grade, right?
Oh, I don't know about that. You don't know me.
Well, you know, it's not like they're going to learn something from being suspended.
No,
right?
That's
true. There's typically something else going on that we should be paying attention to, you know, teaching them social-emotional skills. Perhaps they have an emerging mental illness, you know, perhaps there's something happening at home that's making it difficult for them to sit still or whatever it might be. So really looking at children's mental health we think is critical. One of the programs that has been sponsored by Senator Franken and that we have worked on in Minnesota is called School-Linked Mental Health. If you think about it, the percentage of women working outside the home now is very high.
Right.
Minnesota has one of the highest rates. And we're also a very rural state, and, you know, especially outside the metropolitan area. You can drive for, you know, hours and with it hitting just small towns. Well, if you have a child that needs mental health therapy, which could be 20, you know, once a week for 20 weeks, not many families can take off of work once a week for 20 weeks.
Right.
Right? It's very hard. But we also don't think it's the school's responsibility to actually treat mental illness. So what we did is created a program where the mental health professionals actually go into the schools and co-locate there, mm-hmm. but they're not employees of the school district. They're employees of a mental health center. And so the nice thing is that the kids just walk down the hallway to get their treatment. They don't have to, you know, be removed from school. So they're out of the classroom a lot less. The therapist can see the child in their own milieu, so they can see how they're interacting with teachers and other students. They can help the teacher figure out what some accommodations could be for that child to help them be successful. And it really has worked. We've seen the kids' symptoms go down, suspensions go down, reading scores go up. And probably most significantly, when we look at the data, it shows pretty much every year that half of the children had never received treatment before, mm-hmm. and half of right. those children had a serious mental illness, which means you know they weren't doing well in school.
Right, right.
And we're not in all the school buildings yet. We're in about 85% of school districts and about a little over 40% of actual school buildings. But it's a program that everybody loves, including superintendents and principals, because they really see fewer disturbances in the classroom because kids are getting the help that they need. And I think we need to do more of that across the country.
I agree.
Because, you know, with any illness, early identification and treatment leads to the best outcomes.
That's right. And it's ironic, but do you find that some parents don't realize or they don't want to believe that their child has a mental health issue?
We're finding that less and less. I mean, certainly parents are reluctant to medicate their children, and they should be leery of doing mm-hmm. that until it's really necessary. But we've often found that things, you know, like therapy, mindfulness training, meditation, yoga, social-emotional learning can really help kids be, you know, frankly, better students and be more connected to others in their community if they can get that additional help. But more and more parents are kind of coming around on that issue.
Well, that's good, actually, you know, because I know every now and then teaching support, you know, running support groups and teaching family-to-family classes, you find individuals sometimes who just don't want to accept the fact that their loved one has a mental illness. And, you know, oh, it's something,
right.
you know, they'll get over it. It's, you know, youth or whatever, you know. And I know it's getting less, which is good, you know, but it's still there, unfortunately.
Now, yeah. Sue, may I ask, on this program, what age, is this all age of school kids, or do they start in kindergarten and just do third? Kindergarten through third, or what?
They do all the grades.
Mm-hmm.
They started with the younger, with elementary. Most mm-hmm. school districts did, just because they wanted, again, to address issues very early, like school refusal for kids who have high anxiety and things like that.
Right.
But we see high school students, you know, they need assistance as well.
I would think with the younger children, there might be a little bit of stigma to be being pulled out of class. Is there a way they do that so that it's not so obvious they're going to go see the therapist during the day, or does it happen after school or what?
It happens during the day, but it's really funny. I think it actually has really reduced stigma.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you'll have kids going, they're like, oh, that's Miss Nancy. I'd like to go see Miss Nancy someday.
So
the little kids don't really, you know, their perception in so many areas, right, in terms of bias, is really not there like it is as you get older. So mm-hmm. We have not found that to be a problem, amazingly enough.
Okay, great.
Yeah, it's amazing that, you know, the highest rate of serious mental illness is between young adults between 18 and 25. And less than 26 and older.
Right.
You know, and it's just, it's so tough because a lot of times young adults, either below 18 or in that area, you know, 15, 16, whatever, they not only have a mental health issue, but they may have a drug or alcohol issue along with it. And that's tough for parents to try to combat. You know, which do they do first, the drugs or the alcohol, or they do the mental health, or, you know, and it is very difficult for parents, you know. I'm sure you find that also.
Well, and Larry, I think that's why there's been a greater push for more integrated treatment, because it's kind of like the chicken and the egg. Which came first? Are they self-medicating, or, you know, was it depression first and they started self-medicating? Was it they were using alcohol and they became depressed, or whatever it might be? And so I think it's the kind of integrated approach where you're treating both at the same time we've seen to be the most effective. But I know it's hard to kind of get those providers to do that, but I think it really is an important piece.
Right,
I also think with high school students, you know, when you think about some of the symptoms you should worry about, crabbiness, right, sleep disruptions, I mean, those are also typical teenage things. And so trying to figure out, okay, is this more intense than normal? Is it lasting longer than normal? Is this when I should be worried? Also makes it, I think, really difficult for parents.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, hindsight's always 20/20. I know we have four kids, and two boys, a girl, and a boy. And when our youngest son was a teenager, mid-teens, and was doing these things, we wrote it all, oh, he's a teenager, you know. We had three others that went through this, you know. So it was just, you know, being a teenager. In reality, it wasn't. But, you know, we looked at it at that time as, you know, because whoever, nobody ever thought about mental illness, you know. It was just, he was being a teenager, you know. So it is sad, you know, that we can't get more of that out there to the public, you know.
Well, and I think teachers, too, we actually were the first state in the country to require teachers to have continuing education on the early warning signs of mental illness in children and youth. And it really did help them see. It was just a two-hour training during their five-year renewal period.
Right.
But it helped them see that there's some of the behaviors that they might see, be seeing in their classroom were actually symptoms of a mental illness. And then actually just last year, we now require them to have 1 hour of suicide prevention training as well, so that they're really equipped to deal with whatever comes into their classroom.
Another question I want to ask is, in New Jersey, housing for folks with a mental health issue is a big issue. There's such a lack of housing that it's totally pathetic. How is it in Minnesota?
Yeah, housing, you know, we know that you can't get better if you don't have stable housing.
Right.
And even in looking at some of the data when they say, well, you know, you should have this many hospital beds per population, we never look at least I don't think, I've never seen anyone really look carefully at how did someone end up in the hospital in the first place? How did someone end up in the jail in the first place? And what we know from very preliminary data is that often, especially in the jail, it's people who are also homeless or have very unstable housing.
Right.
And so, you know, if you think about how cheap it would be, frankly, to provide them with a safe place to live versus paying what we do for hospitals, inpatient hospital care, or even a jail stay, it just blows my mind. So
ours too.
We really want to push for, you know, supportive, affordable housing. It's just so much cheaper than anything else that we can do. And you have to start somewhere.
Yeah, you do. And it's unfortunate because I know the county we live in, Hunterdon County, is considered, I don't know, I've heard second wealthiest in the country, third wealthiest. But either way, it's very wealthy. And I keep asking my wife, what are we doing here? You know, but and, you know, you can't find beds for people. It's very, very hard to get an apartment or whatever. I know my son, about 6 years ago, got lucky and got an apartment through HUD. And but, you know, it's not easy. And if it's not easy, you know, in areas that are not as say, wealthy, considered wealthy. Can you imagine how bad it is in areas that are considered wealthy? Mm. You know, and it's just a shame because, mm-hmm. you know, they want people to get out and to back into society and, you know, but there's no place for them to live.
Right. Yeah.
And a lot of them don't have driver's license for various reasons. And where we are, transportation is not what it would be like in, I believe, Minnesota or, you know, like in Minneapolis or, you know, areas or mm-hmm. cities. So we have a problem that way. We have a thing called the link, but it's like, you know, it doesn't run every day. It only runs 6 days a week and only certain times and, you know, that sort of thing. So it's not, you know, it's not the, it's better than nothing, but it's not the answer to the problem, you know.
Right.
Sue, yeah. I wanted to ask you, you know, since your NAMI has been around so long, what kind of buy-in do you have from the governor and the state legislature on mental health issues? Do you feel that it's a good state in terms of recognition of the problem at the legislative level?
You know, I think it's pretty good. We work very hard to educate our elected officials on these issues. For example, during campaign season, when they're running for re-election, every person running for the legislature gets a letter from us every week explaining a different issue related to mental illness and the mental health community. And then during the non-election years, we actually hold what we call house parties. So we invite the two representatives and senator from the district to someone's home or the library or coffee shop just to talk about some of the issues. So we think that helps. I do like to joke that we have been supported and screwed by both parties. So we don't see it as a Democratic or a Republican thing. We actually have champions in both parties. Mm-hmm. And so I think that part is helpful. We work closely with our departments, you know, human services, our Medicaid folks and things like that, education, because sometimes you can work with them more easily than a governor's office. Mm-hmm. But I will say that we have had good support from our governors over the years as well. Certainly you have to keep pushing for things, and there's a lot of competing demands these days, but I would say we've done pretty well in terms of increasing the funding for our mental health system. Mm-hmm. In Minnesota, we've kind of taken to saying that we don't have a broken mental health system. The reality is we never built it. And I think it's really a different perspective to think about it that way, because really if you look at the history of our mental health system across the country, when you know, President Eisenhower came out really with the very first, you know, huge report on what we should do in our mental health system. And his report said that we should have a community mental health center for every 50,000 people. Every hospital should have an inpatient psychiatric unit. We needed to make sure that we recruited people to the workforce, particularly child psychiatrists. We need to have emergency mental health care. So if you think about it, this is what Eisenhower recommended, right? I mean, who needs another study, right?
Right.
I mean, these are all things that would work well. And mm-hmm. when President Kennedy took those issues and said, okay, we're going to build community mental health centers, and we're going to close the institutions, which he was right to close them. They were horrible places to be. Those were black grant dollars. I mean, there was never a steady stream of funding for mental health services. And so I think, you know, that's something for us to keep in mind even today as they're talking about black granting, you know, Medicaid, is that when it's a black grant, it gets cut. And that's certainly what happened in terms of building our mental health system and replacing the institutions.
In your opinion, if we can't get more beds, what are some of the other solutions that we have to look at?
Well, you know, my problem with only looking at beds is that people spend less than 1% of their life in a hospital bed. They spend the rest of the time in the community. So if we're not making sure that they have services available to them in the community, whether it's assertive community treatment teams, in-home services, drop-in centers, clubhouses, mm-hmm. you know, access to therapists and medication when they need it. We're spending the money at the, you know, the highest cost part of our system without looking at what we can do earlier. There's a lot of work now being done on the first psychotic episode programs through the National Institute of Mental Health, and we also got some state money here in Minnesota to help expand that. And when you think about it, the way we talk to legislators about it is if you go to your doctor and your doctor says you have cancer, he or she doesn't say, come back when you hit stage four.
Yeah, right.
But that's exactly what we do in the mental health system.
Mm-hmm.
You have your first psychotic episode. You may be developing schizophrenia, one of the most disabling conditions in the world. And what do? Nothing, right? Maybe someone gets hospitalized, you know, for a couple months, but we don't do anything typically until someone's been hospitalized or committed a number of times. And we just wouldn't do that with any other illness. So I think the more that we can think about how do we identify people early, provide intensive services, not mediocre, right, not waiting 3-4 months to get in to see a psychiatrist, I think that that's money well spent, and we can serve so many more people than mm-hmm. just one hospital bed. I think we have to think about how do we avoid hospital beds, right, and provide that treatment to people in the community.
I don't know if you find it in Minnesota, but I notice a lot of people that I speak to, their loved one comes out of the hospital and doesn't get to see the psychiatrist for 4 to 6 weeks. Now, you just spent X amount of period of time, whatever it is, in a regimented timetable, and now you don't get to see the psychiatrist for 4 to 6 weeks. That doesn't make any sense.
It's kind of like falling off a cliff.
Exactly. And,
right.
You know, it's just, it's sad. But I know, I don't know about Minnesota, but I know in our county survey, we're supposed to have 39 psychiatrists. We have 4. So mm-hmm. it's, you know, and there's more and more people who are switching from, psychiatry to other, you know, medical fields. And it's just sad because there's not enough anywhere, I don't think. But I know there's not enough around here, you know.
Well, I think there's shortages in many places except maybe, you know, New York and California. But one of the things that I found interesting, because we did delve into this issue, and I personally did a lot of research on it, and what I found is that they actually have a lot of people wanting to go into psychiatry, but there are not enough residency slots. So some states are actually funding psychiatry residency slots, including here in Minnesota, and there's other states that are doing it as well, which is really troubling to me that on a national level, they're not saying, yes, we need more work in this area, so let's add funding to add residency slots,
right.
And they're not doing it. So I read a recent article where most of the 98% of the psychiatry residency slots were filled. You know, sometimes it's where they're located, right? You know, mm-hmm. that people don't want to, they can't get the state they need to be in, then they're not going to do it, which is why we're trying to grow them here in Minnesota, right? if they're a resident here, maybe they'd stay here. But I do think that's an issue that we need to make sure that that we have enough training programs that people can participate in.
Right. I agree. I know from personal experience with my own son, who's paranoid schizophrenic, how very helpful it is for him to have gotten a job. Mm-hmm. And I just would like you to speak to the, you know, your opinion, the power of employment, if you would.
Well, you know, I think the old school was that, you know, we don't want to add stress to people's lives, so we don't want them to work. And I think that really is a disservice to people. Especially mental illness. You know, if you're sitting in your apartment all day, frankly, smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee, and watching daytime TV, you are not going to get better.
Right.
And employment, even if it's volunteer, but paid employment is a great thing, you're out of your apartment.
Mm-hmm.
You have a structure to your day. You're interacting with other people, and you're working your way out of poverty, frankly, because usually Social Security payments are pretty low for people with a mental illness.
Right.
And when I think of young people in particular, which is why I think, you know, Medicaid expansion was so important, you know, if you were a young person, 22 years old, diagnosed with schizophrenia, and you were told that the only way you could get the treatment that you needed was, frankly, to go to the Social Security Administration and say, I will never work again, so you could get SSI and get Medicaid, what a horrible thing to do to a young person. right? We don't want them to ever lose that dream. And so, you know, I think with Medicaid expansion, so you can get it and get the treatment that you need just because you don't have any money, that you're employed, so you might not necessarily have to depend on Social Security, or at least you can add to your income, you know, up to a certain point. It just gives more meaning to all our lives. We all need a reason to get up in the morning.
Exactly.
We hire a lot of people with mental illness here at NAMI, and we've had people, psychiatrists, say, what are you doing different? You're so much better. And they're like, well, I have a part-time job.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right. Exactly.
I just think that's really critical. We're all kind of defined by what we do, whether it's caring for children, you know, as a stay-at-home parent, or by the work that we do in the world.
Sure. I know I volunteered, I have been for quite a few years at the hospital, and I coerced, for lack of a better word, my son to volunteer. And it was like a different world for him.
Yeah.
It gave him a reason to get up in the morning and, you know, get showered and get cleaned up and, you know, and the people in the hospital loved him. He knew them, they knew him, and, you know. And now he has gotten, well, last a little over 2 years, he got a part-time job at BJ's, and he loves it. You know, he works maybe Wednesday to Saturday, and, you know, 3 days, 4 days a week, depending. But it also gives him a reason, you know, and he has income, and, you know, he's never going to be wealthy, but he has a reason to get up, and he feels, you know, like he's doing something of importance. And, you know, all of this. And I think it's so wonderful there are various companies and organizations and what have you hire people with mental illness, you know, so that they feel like they're back and part of society, you know, and that they're contributing, and rather than just standing there with their hand out, you know.
I agree. I think it's really important. And we've actually had for a couple of years a program for employers, like a lunch and learn, about accommodations for mental illness. So they kind of understand some of the symptoms they might be seeing, even if it's mild depression in an employee that they currently have. We want to make sure people don't lose their jobs,
right?
You know, even before perhaps they're diagnosed. And we just kind of go through what some of the accommodations are, because people understand what accommodations someone in a wheelchair might need, but they don't understand what an accommodation might be for someone with ADHD or depression or bipolar or schizophrenia. And so we kind of walk through some of the very inexpensive accommodations that can be made. One of the things that we actually do here at NAMI is for folks who have difficulty concentrating, you can actually get $300 headphones that block out the noise. Because sometimes if you just listen to music, you have to turn it up too loud, and then it kind of gives you a headache. But this blocks out all the noise and distractions, which really can help people concentrate. Putting those little sad lights, especially in Minnesota, you know, at your desk can help someone with depression.
Right.
You know, really encouraging people to take more frequent breaks so that they get up, they walk around. Even talking about kind of work-life balance and with employers can also be, you know, very helpful, so they kind of understand some of the steps that they can do to keep their employees mentally well, because that does impact their bottom line.
Sure, absolutely. I know in the last couple minutes, I just want to go over something. It was in one of the Twitters that you sent, you know, or Minnesota sent, and I don't know how I ever got on that thing, but I'm happy I did. But anyway, this Eleanor McChance Katz, I think is how you say her name. She's a PhD. She's the Assistant Secretary for Mental Health and Substance Abuse at the Department of Health and Human Services. And she has said that since 2002, heroin use increased 230%. Heroin related deaths have gone up 630%. And she believes some of this may be caused by drug mixing, adding fentanyl to heroin, and, you know. But I know that a lot of, I've spoken to many, many people, parents who lost their son or daughter through suicide, and part of it was drug-related, and some wasn't, but, you know, but the person was taking drugs and such. Do you find that this is pertinent in Minnesota also? I would assume it is.
Yes. There, you know, I think in part of it's related to the opioid crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So when people can no longer get their hands on opioids, they turn to heroin,
right.
Which can be really cheap right now, too.
It is actually cheap.
Unfortunately, more accessible, right?
Right.
So I do think, I think this is an issue across the country. We have a lot of deaths in Minnesota related to heroin and opioids, and there's just a lot more that we need to do. And I do think one of the problems is the really huge prescriptions that they give you for opioids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go in for, you know, day surgery, wisdom teeth out, you know, whatever it might be,
right.
And you don't get one or two, right? You end up getting like 20,
yeah.
And nobody needs that many.
Yeah.
And so I know there's steps taken, you know, across the country and states to really limit the number of pills that go into a bottle for each prescription so that it's just less available.
And, you know, it's, you know, people say, well, why? Well, and not everybody that overdoses has a mental illness, but a good percentage of them do. And
yeah.
Those that have the mental illness, it's been proven time and again that they do the drugs or alcohol, whatever it may be, to reduce the pain that they're feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And I know from, I had a doctor on who has a two clinics, one in Pennsylvania and one in Jersey, and she was saying that it's like cutting. They'd rather cut themselves, some people, because that pain takes away the pain that they have in their head. And
sure.
It's just sad, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. And, you know, to think that, I've said before on the air, we're talking to people that one time volunteering in the hospital, I went to speak to, they have a section of the hospital that's lock and key, they call it, you know, the... But I used to go there and talk on Saturdays to the patients. And this one young man said to me, "Can I speak to you after?" I said, "Sure." So we were talking outside. And, you know, all of a sudden he says, "I want to show you something." He rolled up his sleeves on both arms. And there wasn't a piece of flesh that wasn't scarred from his shoulder all the way down. And he cut himself all the time. And I was flabbergasted. I didn't know what to say. And I'm not usually at a loss for words. And I just was like, oh, man, you know, and I just didn't know what to say.
Mm-hmm.
And he was explaining to me that the pain that he felt, it was easier to feel the pain on his, you know, when he cut himself than it was to listen or feel the pain that he was going through with his mental health issues. And I just, you know, it's just so sad. And,
yeah.
You know, and to see people... You know, using heroin or, you know, any kind of drugs or whatever, or drinking, and then, you know, committing suicide, it's just, you know, their whole lives are ahead of them, and then they're ending them, you know? And it's like
right.
They, you know, they feel they have no life, and, you know, what's the sense of going on, you know? And unfortunately, like
well, you
I
know,
said.
The previous Surgeon General had really talked about how we need to look at substance use disorders
mm-hmm.
as disorders and not about willpower,
right.
Which I think is also really important. And, you know, some people are just more susceptible to becoming addicted than others. And so
yes.
I think that makes it more difficult as well. But I think the co-occurring piece is really important. And we need to get much better in this country about treating them both at the same time and not worrying about, again, which came first.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And I agree with you, you know, that they both should be treated at the same time. I just mm-hmm. find it difficult, or people that I've spoken to who weren't professionals find it difficult to do that because one overlaps into the other and there's, like, you know, no set. What may be good for heroin or alcohol may not be good for the person's mental health issue. And,
right.
You know, so it's kind of difficult to do it that way.
Sue, we just have a few minutes left. I want to veer into a real quick topic. Larry found out about you through social media. Are you finding ways to use it successfully in spreading the word about mental illness?
You know, surprisingly, yes. You know, I think Twitter and Facebook, even more than Instagram, we don't use that as much. But you are able to really provide information. And what we find in looking at just the statistics about which posts get the most likes and response to them is when we're providing information about what's happening in Minnesota or in Congress about mental health, public policy, new services that are being developed, and then when people share their personal stories. And we do know from the research that the effect of personal stories is the best in terms of changing public attitudes because you can find someone that's like you. Mm-hmm. Right? And so you kind of bring down the brick walls around stigma. So we have a pretty big following on Twitter and Facebook. People are pretty interactive, which we appreciate in terms of sharing their comments about posts. But I do think it really is an effective way. Obviously, the age range is usually a little bit younger for Twitter. It's not necessarily, it's about the all ages in terms of Facebook. But I think it's just another tool, frankly, to reach out to help educate people about mental illnesses.
You know, it's ironic because I don't go on Facebook, I don't go on Twitter or anything like that. And I got your thing through email. You know, it was NAMI Minnesota
well, actually, the growing
said
group
this.
On Facebook is older women.
Yeah. Well, but like I said, it's you know, I got this in the email. And it's you know it's and it comes like NAMI Minnesota tweeted.
Oh yes, our e-news, and we put our kind of our biggest Twitter feeds on there.
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
and that's how I got it. How you got my email? I don't have any idea, but I don't care. I was happy you got it because
some of those things are mysteries. Right?
Yeah, well, you know, and some of them I don't want to figure out, but. You know, if someone wanted to reach out to you, I know because we're on the internet, so it goes all over. So people in Minnesota could hear this also. If they wanted to reach out to you, is there a website or a phone number or something like that you could give out?
Yes. So our website is simply www.namihelps.org. And if you wanted to email us, it would be namihelps@namimn.org. But all our email addresses are up there as well, and our Twitter feed is @NAMI Minnesota, as is our Facebook page.
Okay.
So you write out Minnesota, you don't abbreviate MN or something?
Not for the Twitter feed or Facebook, correct.
Okay. Yeah.
Is there a phone number that they could reach you on?
Yes. Our phone number is 651-645-2948.
Why don't you give it again?
And we have a lot of great information on our website. We developed a lot of booklets here in Minnesota, including first episode of Psychosis, what family and friends need to know and what they should be advocating for. And the National Institute of Mental Health liked it so much, it's also on their website.
Mm-hmm.
So people might find some helpful information through our website as well.
Well, I really thank you. I can't believe the time went flew by so fast.
I think we got a lot.
It does go by fast, doesn't it?
We got a lot of really good ideas from you. Thank you.
Oh, good.
About things, you know, just some programs that I've never heard of that sound like they could be very effective. Appreciate it.
And I will send you.
Well, I think it's important that we all share what we know in order to really improve the lives of children and adults with mental illnesses.
Absolutely. I will email you, Sue. How to download this show so you could maybe put it on your Facebook or Twitter or whatever you put it on. All that stuff I'm not familiar with. But I will email you later on today and, you know, send it out to you and let you know how to get, you know, how you can download it. You can't do it till tomorrow anyway, so I'll send it to you tonight.
Okay. But,
all right.
Sounds great.
Thank you very much, Sue.
Well, I just want to say thank you so much for having me on.
Sue, I really appreciate you coming on, and I you know, we've been listening to Sue Abderholden. Is that right?
Abderholden.
Okay. Couldn't have had Smith as a last name, huh? But anyway, Sue Abderholden is the executive director of NAMI Minnesota, and it's been a pleasure, Sue. It really has. And I
thank you so much.
I hope we talk again in the future.
Thank you, Sue.
Sounds good.
Thank you. Have a good day. You too. Bye bye. You've been listening to Mental Health Matters, and we'll be back again, same time, same station, next week. And remember, folks, mental health really does matter.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
I'm your eyes remain, stop me when I'm passing by.
It's time to visit Pambies, the newest ice cream shop in town. Pambies Purely Delicious Ice Cream, Gelato, and Sorbet, made in Hunterdon County from unique blends of natural extracts, herbs, and spices. Created with a rich, creamy texture bursting with flavor. Tickle your palate with exotic flavors such as rose cardamom, hot mango, and ginger lemon. Or satisfy your craving for dark chocolate, pecans, and caramel. Located on Route 31 south of Clinton. Pambies Purely Delicious.
See now all my flavors are guaranteed to satisfy.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
The news is sponsored by the Hunterdon Medical Center. Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's physician referral service at 1-800-511-4HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
USA Radio News with Jason Wirt.
To honor the people of our nations, we must ensure that no one and no member state shoulders a disproportionate share of the burden.
President Trump, in his address to the United Nations General Assembly, calling for overhauls within the world body, he said the United Nations needs to regain the world's trust.
We seek a United Nations that regains the trust of the people around the world. In order to achieve this, the United Nations must hold every level of management accountable protect whistleblowers, and focus on results rather than on process.
A fourth day of protests underway in St. Louis, Missouri, after the acquittal of a white police officer. He was found not guilty of shooting a black heroin dealer who was reaching for a gun to shoot at police. A peaceful group took place downtown this morning, 80 arrested last night in violence. USA Radio News.
Good news, everyone. Futurama is back in an all-new episode that's available for audio download or listening today. And it's free. The new episode, created by the original Futurama team, came to life after they were reunited to create new content for Jam City's mobile game, Futurama Worlds of Tomorrow. Executive producer David X. Cohen says the cast had a great time creating both the video game and the 42-minute-long